It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Voltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Researchers used to argue that strong family ties could help us survive when we had little money, even for the basics. And now we're discovering that life in low-income families includes strained relationships and a lack of trust. And that makes living in poverty and escaping it even more difficult. We're learning about those relationships, the kinds of environments that create them, and how we can better understand the social dimensions of poverty. How do you see this social poverty affecting your community? Have you experienced hard times yourself? Did you have to move in with your parents to get back on your feet? Or maybe you avoided family and friends because you didn't think they were rooting for you? Share your story, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor of human development and family studies at the University of Wisconsin School of Human Ecology. She wrote the book Social Poverty, Low-Income Parents, and the Struggle for Family and Community Ties. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
At the beginning of your book, we meet Jessica and Will, and their story, we find out, isn't unique. They're trying to raise two kids together, and they're participating in this program. Introduce us to these two.
So Jessica is 19, but she's a seasoned mother by the time I met her for the first time. And she has been a stay-at-home mom to Will's toddler, who he had when he was in his first year of college, which led him to drop out. They're expecting their second child when I meet them, their first child together. And Jessica and Will have had some bumps in the road in their relationship, but with this child coming, they really want to make their family life work this time. They want to raise this child together. And so Jessica knows that that means they need to shore up their relationship. She wants Will to step up to the plate more. He had really left a lot of the work around the house to her and not helped out so much. And she also knows she needs to work on her trust issues. She saw so much when she was growing up, which was really just happening since she's only 19. And she knows that that affects her ability to trust Will today. And she really wants to work to overcome that.
Yeah, right away, we're struck by this idea that even Jessica is aware that she's saying, I've seen this with the people in my life. They haven't been there. They haven't done the things I needed them to or taken care of other families well. And I don't want to have that happen to me.
Yeah, she even goes back to before she was born. She says she knows that her dad cheated on her mom while her mom was pregnant with her. And she said, I know I wasn't there for that, but I felt it. And that sense of not being able to trust the people in your life continued as she was growing up. So her dad eventually left the family and developed a drug addiction. Her mom repartnered, and then her stepdad ran out on her little siblings the way that her dad had on her. And she felt like she was seeing history repeat all over again. And then on top of that, after her stepdad had left, leaving her mom sort of floundering to take care of the kids and deal with this disintegrating relationship, her grandfather, who was like the one man in her life who did the right thing, passed away. And Jessica just said, I felt like I had nothing left.
The way you describe that, the word cycle comes to mind. And that's often how we talk about financial poverty. How does that equate with this social poverty concept?
I think it's definitely the case that people are influenced by their experiences as they're growing up. And that can make it easier and harder for them to trust the people around them or to follow a sort of relationship role model that they see. If people around you have showed you how to communicate and solve conflict in a healthy way, it's going to be easier to figure out how to do that in your own relationships as you're older.
How does that relate to economic poverty? When we say poverty, we're often talking about finance.
Yeah, we are. And I'm using the term poverty here really purposefully. Often when we focus, especially on low-income people, we really just focus on their dollars and cents experiences. We think, well, you're having trouble making ends meet. That's the only thing you could possibly be focusing on. But as we see in real life, people are multifaceted. There are a lot of things people care about. Even if they're struggling financially or even if they have all the money in the world, it really matters to them whether there are people in their lives that they can trust and depend on. And so that's why I developed this concept concept of social poverty in the book as a sort of counterbalance to this idea of financial poverty. It's not to say that money doesn't matter, but to say that there are another set of resources that really matter to people, and that are the relationships in their lives, whether there are people who you can depend on, who you can trust, and who you can be vulnerable with, who you know have your back.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is the author of Social Poverty, Low-Income Parents, and the Struggle for Family and Community Ties. I'm Keely Boltina, and we are talking about this social poverty today, and we're wondering what your understanding of it is. Where have you seen this, a family member endure this, or maybe you supported friends that felt like they were trying to get their lives together, but they just couldn't because of the people around them? 800-642-1234, or you can tweet at WPR Mornings. Sarah, what are some of the consequences of social poverty when we have this lack of trust, this lack of ability to rely on other people?
So psychologists and health researchers have done some really fascinating research, finding out that this is not about having hurt feelings. This has serious physical and mental health consequences. So it's not just that it would put you at greater risk for experiencing depression or something like that, but the stress of not having adequate social support actually gets in your body. And we see inflammation responses. We see effects on mortality and morbidity. We see that moms who lack proper support when they're pregnant have poor birth outcomes. And we also know that this translates through generations, because parents who lack proper support have a harder time parenting in sensitive and responsive ways to help their kids.
How do you assess whether someone is socially poor? How do we figure out what the criteria are?
So this is one of the ways that it's harder than financial poverty to think about. Our federal government provides us with a perhaps flawed but, you know, straightforward way of counting who's poor and who's not. And social poverty is inherently subjective. So the amount of relationships that one person might need to feel like their needs are met could be really different than somebody else. We have different personalities. We have different social and emotional needs. And so how many of those ties does somebody need to feel connected, grounded, supported might vary from person to person. So it depends on how somebody views themselves. Do they feel like there are people they can reach out to when they need them?
Are people below that financial poverty line automatically socially poor?
No. And so there's a wide array of factors that are going to increase the likelihood of somebody experiencing social poverty. And it certainly is not the case that just because you're struggling financially, you're going to struggle socially. And it's also the case that just because you're not struggling financially doesn't mean you will avoid social poverty. So those two could go hand in hand, as in the case of Jessica and Will, but they don't have to.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an author and an associate professor at UW-Madison. And this hour, we are talking about social poverty. And we're specifically having a conversation about low-income families and the challenges that they face, not just at the bank, but in finding safe space with family and when they are developing community ties. There's room for your story. What does social poverty look like in your life? Did a lack of money in your family lead people to do things that hurt you, that made you trust them a little less? How did you get through it? And what does your life look like now? We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. And we're on Twitter. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. There's room for your thoughts as we talk this hour about social poverty. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show right here on the Ideas Network. Our guest characterizes it as finding a way in the dark. Adults becoming partners and new parents, but without those real-life experiences that show them how to fulfill those roles well. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about social poverty. And one piece of it is that concept that children who grow up without stable networks of people they can trust, they're more likely to grapple with finding their way when they have relationships of their own. Have you been part of a program that helps low-income families forge strong relationships? Did it help you? Maybe you struggled and wish someone had tried to help you be a better partner or a better parent. How would that have changed your life? 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at wpr.org. Ideas at wpr.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor at UW-Madison, and her book about social poverty looks at these connections between relationships and financial poverty. Let's dive into this program about family expectations. It's something you really focus on to help us understand the issue of social poverty. Take us to Oklahoma City. How does it work?
So there's this program that's been running for more than a decade in Oklahoma City that offers what people call relationship education. And so that's a group setting where you get together for several weeks and you learn about some tools for having a more successful relationship. And there are things that people who have been to therapy would perhaps find familiar. So it's things like learning about healthy communication and conflict, making sure that you know how to take a time out before things get too heated, learning to phrase things so that you're saying, you know, when you do this in this situation, this is how it makes me feel, instead of saying, you always, you know, leave your socks on the floor, you never help me out. So avoiding that sort of accusation and being able to have conflict and communication in more successful ways. The program also covers some basics about infant care, because it recruits new parents, people who are just about to have or have just had a child together. And so these parents walk through this program together, get support from program staff, and the hope is come out a stronger family unit on the other side.
Francisco from Sister Bay is with us and wants to talk about that socialization. Francisco, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I have been a teacher. I have been a student. I got a PhD. I got a JD. I got a master's degree. I got an associate degree. And I know what we teach the children. And it starts there, the elementary school children. We teach them to stand on your own two feet, to be self-reliant, and we don't should not expect help from anybody, and they believe it. And so that this social isolation is very endemic and more appropriate for the United States. We don't have psychiatrists in other countries, like Mexico. We take care of our own. And so that your social isolation that you talk about, it's a byproduct of the type of system we have chosen to live under in this United States. And to get away from that, if you expect people to help you, then you're a socialist, you're a communist, you're a populist.
Francisco, thank you for that point. Sarah, is there this shame in being socially poor? Is this something that may be uniquely American?
I think there certainly is a shame in asking for help, and that can make this relationship between needing social support and needing financial support really complex, because it can mean that if you ask for help from a family member, for financial help from a family member, that can possibly weigh on that relationship, because as Francisco said, we should be standing on our own two feet. And so that sort of, you know, go it yourselfness, pull yourself up by your bootstraps can add a whole other element to asking for and receiving help.
You know, we're talking about this this program about family expectations out of Oklahoma City, and people disagree on the value and the effectiveness of government-run programs that support different kinds of relationships. You know, what does that criticism look like, and is it valid?
So I think a first point that's really important to lay out is that these sort of relationship education programs are not unique to low-income folks. So these programs long existed before they were government-funded. Lots of middle-class married couples have gone to marriage retreats and things like that. And so these the institution of these government-funded programs was really sort of making accessible something that middle-class class and upper income people had long done, and making it available to people who couldn't afford, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars to go to a marriage workshop. And so these programs are funded through our welfare dollars, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, which is a whole mouthful. That was the welfare reform legislation that was passed in the 1990s under the Clinton administration, actually sort of created these programs. They weren't funded until George W. Bush's administration. And the findings have been varied about how efficacious various programs were. And it really varies from site to site. I was lucky enough to be at a site in Oklahoma City that has been found to be relatively effective, has pretty good participation, and has seen some positive impacts on parents. There are questions about how large these impacts are and how large we should expect them to be from this sort of few weeks intervention.
The book is called Social Poverty, Low-Income Parents, and the Struggle for Family and Community Ties. Author Sarah Halpern-Meekin is our guest. I'm Keely Boltina. How do your relationships with friends and family affect your overall well-being? Do you feel they've done more harm than good? Are those community ties the reason you're surviving financial poverty? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And I want to welcome Belinda from Winchester. Hi, Belinda.
Hi, good morning.
Tell me your story.
So I came up kind of from a poverty level. I have two children. My ex-husband and myself struggled a lot coming kind of out of poverty, trying to instill good values and good community bonds with our kids growing up. But it was a really difficult situation. We live in a very rural area, way up in northern Wisconsin here, and finding those resources to kind of help us was a really difficult situation. I think that we had a lot of issues coming up with a lot of dysfunction, a lot of family trauma, and then trying to kind of not pass those on to our kids was a big struggle. Finding those resources and getting past the stigma of those resources was really difficult.
Belinda, what did you figure out worked?
I think it came down to realizing that we weren't the only ones, that there were a lot of people kind of in our same situation and in our same boat. Finding some of that small areas of community support, getting involved with even like fire and ambulance departments, something that kind of drew us more into the community and kind of raised our social networking within the community to kind of get that support to help pull us up and out of that and kind of put our children on a path of seeing those positive things that are in the community and those positive things that we were able to do as parents.
Excellent. Thanks, Belinda. Sarah, what do you hear there?
There were two things that Belinda said that really stuck out to me and really resonated with so many of the stories that I heard from the parents who I met when I was researching this book. And the first is how strongly motivated so many parents are to do well by their children, to say, this didn't work for me. I'm not going to let that happen again for my kids. And that was what led so many of the parents I met to walk through the doors of this Family Expectations Program. They had a lot going on in their lives, but they were willing to add one more thing to their plates because they wanted to give their children the best family lives that they could. The other thing that stuck out to me from what Belinda said was that she really needed to see that she wasn't alone in her struggles. And that was one of the things that seemed really powerful about these group workshops that I got to observe. Parents got to walk us beside other parents and see, oh, it just because you're having an argument in your relationship doesn't mean there's something wrong. You can have that argument in a better way, but it doesn't mean this relationship might be too messed up to repair. Or just because it's stressful being a new parent and you're not sleeping and you're exhausted and your hair's a mess and your dishes are a mess and all of that, so's all these other people, and you feel like you're not alone. And having those people walk beside you during those stressful times can help to deal with some of that stress.
Can that role of the community fill a void if you feel like those close family or friends are not there for you?
I think yes and no. I don't think a sort of group setting is going to ever be a replacement for the really close, intense personal bonds. But I think it's part of the set of resources that you need in order to feel like you have a sense of belonging, you have a sense of acceptance, you have a sense of normalcy. And what that community is can be different for all of us. It could be a community of gamers. It could be the people at the fire department, like Belinda talked about. It can be the people at your, you know, wine tasting club, whatever it is, all across the spectrum. But having a group of people where you feel accepted and welcomed and understood can really go far in helping people feel comfortable and supported.
We're talking about social poverty with Sarah Halpern-Meekin. We know low-income couples face barriers that people in different income brackets don't. And the decisions they make hinge on challenges that are years or even decades in the making. Money, housing, transportation, trust issues. It's complicated. Our conversation continues this hour with your stories. How do you see social poverty affecting your community? Have you experienced hard times yourself? Did you move back in with your parents to get on your feet? Or did you distance yourself? Tell us about what becoming an adult looked like for you and how you figured it out. 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. This is a conversation about social poverty. And now is the time to share your experience as a person who's had to do without, financially or socially. When did you realize you didn't have family and friends who supported you? Did you isolate yourself from them? Did money keep you tethered to people who you felt didn't have your best interest at heart? And what about now? How have you found reliable relationships and how have those changed your life? 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin teaches human development and family studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Human Ecology. And she wrote the book, Social Poverty, Low-Income Parents, and the Struggle for Family and Community Ties. Sarah, you look at many young adults' different relationships in your research, and people who participate in this program focusing on building relationships have quite a few changes going on in their lives. Tell us about those transitions that they're experiencing.
Yeah. So one of the things that was really striking was just how much people were juggling. So we know that, you know, becoming a parent is a really big transition in life for anybody under any circumstances. But many of the parents I met were becoming parents, were welcoming a child during a time when a lot of the other parts of their life weren't settled. So they were in partnerships that might not be on firm footing, like Jessica and Will, who we talked about at the start of the hour. So they were transitioning to parenthood at the same time that they were transitioning in their partnership. And on top of all of that, they were transitioning to adulthood. They were trying to figure out who they were and what they were going to do and whether they needed more education and what their careers were going to be and if they wanted to explore the world. And all of that is a lot to do. That's a lot of different roles to take on. It's a lot to figure out. And it also makes it really hard to develop trust in relationships and even trust in yourself when so much of who you are and what you're doing is in flux. So trust relies on being able to expect and understand what somebody else is doing and know that they're going to anticipate your needs. And when those needs are changing so much, it's really hard to know that somebody's going to respond to them.
What about the role of families here? Some of the parents that you met say they purposefully separated themselves from their families when they were taking on this new crazy life experience. What about that?
Yeah, it was pretty common that the parents would say they had separated themselves from their friends, especially. And this really points to some of the conflicts between the transition to adulthood and the transition to parenthood. The way we think about young adulthood in the United States is that it's supposed to be this unfettered time. You go out, you party, you're with your friends, you focus on yourself, you do you. And the way we think about parenthood is you are permanently on the back burner. Your child is on the front burner. You do what's best for them under any circumstance. And so that culture around parenthood and the culture around young adulthood are in conflict. To be a good parent in our culture, you can't be doing a good job of partying and putting yourself first. And so they really struggled to be with their friends who were living that young adult lifestyle and to be parents, because those just two just conflict.
What happens when you have people who experience social poverty who don't have this network of trusted examples who are trying to take this on? I mean, who do they look to understand how they can parent?
A lot of the people who I met were really wanting this partnership to work. And they were wanting this partnership to work because they had separated themselves from their friends. You know, so many people said, oh, I don't hang out with my friends. I don't spend time with my friends, or I have one friend. And so this romantic partner was really a primary person, a primary support in their lives. And when that relationship was on shaky footing, it meant they really were facing social poverty. They really were at that precipice. And so sometimes people would still have a good relationship, maybe with one of their parents. And it would be like, I have my mom and I have my, you know, one friend. And then I have my boyfriend, my girlfriend, my fiance. And that's it. And so if any one of those relationships was shaky, it meant people really felt like, you know, as one woman, Ashley, put it, I'd be the loneliest person on earth without him. And so these relationships had a lot hanging on them. There wasn't a robust social network. People often felt like they could fall back on if this relationship faltered.
That's a lot of pressure as a young adult, relying on another young adult just trying to get through it. I mean, that's pressure.
Yeah. Think about trying to figure out your whole future, trying to figure out how to be a partner, and doing that all with your high school girlfriend or boyfriend. It's a lot to put on a relationship early on.
And how important was it for the participants that you studied to, they you know, purposefully separated themselves socially from friends, but to be financially independent from their families, from their parents?
People really want to stand on their own two feet, but their ability to do that really varied. And so it was not uncommon that people would be either living with family at some point in time over the year that I met with them, or to have recently lived with family, because making ends meet on the low-wage work they often had just wasn't going to cut it while they were trying to raise children and bearing the costs of doing that.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin wrote the book Social Poverty, Low-Income Parents, and the Struggle for Family and Community Ties. I'm Keely Boltina, and we want to know, did a lack of money in your family lead people to do things that eroded your trust? How did that change the way that you see the world? Were you a parent relying on, you know, your partner to figure out how to be in this brand new role when there were so many factors that felt like they were working against you? And how did you get through that? 800-642-1234. Sticking with that, what is it like for these young adults who are trying to find their way to have the courage and confidence in these new roles as partners and parents, and then having to step back and say, hi, my own parents, can we live with you? We can't afford to do this on our own.
So it was a lot. There were parents who had moved out and then needed to move back in. So I think in particular of one young man I met, Zach, who had been living on his own. He was 20. He'd been working for a couple years. And then when he found out his girlfriend was pregnant, he sort of said, he totally freaked out.
And normal reaction.
Yes, he needed to get his life in order. His girlfriend was still in high school. She was living with her grandparents who had raised her, and they needed to figure out what their life was going to be like. And that meant, Zach said, he had to totally stop the way he was living his life. He had to stop spending money the way he spent money. He had to stop spending time with friends the way he spent time with friends. And he and his girlfriend ended up moving back in with his mom, which was a source of financial support. He still helped pay the bills at his mom's house. But it also was a source of tension. Moving back in with your parents can mean you're kind of have a kid again in the household when just at the same time that you're becoming a parent yourself. And that's a lot to juggle too, right? So it's not just about figuring out the relationship between Zach and his girlfriend, but he also had to negotiate the relationship with his mom and his younger brother and then his new baby son.
Introduce us to Robert and Elise. You talk about them. They're committed. They're expecting a baby. And one of the reasons they aren't getting married is that they don't have a car.
Robert and Elise were not even living together. So they were really committed to being together, to making this relationship work. They were expecting a baby together, and they couldn't afford to live on their own. So Elise was living with her parents, and Robert was living with his parents, and they hoped that they could move in together again. They had lived together in the past, but this was one of their ways of making sure that they were prepared, that they had some money to cover baby's expenses, was to actually live separately. And so they wanted to make their relationship work, but they also had some problems that they had to deal with. And they, for them, being in this workshop together was really enlightening, because when the workshop leaders would talk about some negative behavior patterns, they could see themselves in these patterns. And Robert explained that just being able to put a word or a label on some of the dynamics in their relationship made it feel so much more likely that they could successfully tackle them. So Robert realized that he would often sort of be dismissive of Elise's concerns if they weren't things that were important to him. And Elise realized that she would often follow Robert around if they were in the middle of a conflict. If he needed to take a break and gather himself, she really felt like she needed to resolve everything right then. And she would follow him around the house trying to resolve things just as he was trying to take a break. And realizing that they had those dynamics going on, they said, helped them to start making progress in resolving them.
I mean, that sort of a relationship can develop when you are living together, when you are married. All of those factors aren't what set up that relationship for those challenges.
Yeah. So there's so much, right? You know, you're trying to figure all of this out, and you're having to hitch rides over to see each other to even resolve these issues in the first place. And so I think resolving these challenges in a relationship is difficult for anybody, regardless of your financial circumstances. But their financial circumstances add a whole nother layer of challenge to successfully addressing some of these relationship issues that they were facing.
And that car issue brings us back to that connection between social poverty and economic poverty, that it's just this cycle that they can really reveal things about the other.
Right. And so you can see just how lacking some financial resources can make it hard to invest in your social resources. So if you don't have a car and you live in a place like Oklahoma City or many places in the United States that don't have good public transportation.
Most of Wisconsin.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Just being able to get out to see friends, to connect with people socially, can be really challenging. There was one couple I met who felt like they were stuck in their housing project. Unless they could hitch a ride, they couldn't get out. And the man said it felt like they were living under a black cloud, that their home was really a prison. And when their baby was born prematurely, they had to find rides to the hospital to even see their baby. And so we can see how these lack of financial resources can just be an additional challenge for people as they try to strengthen their social networks.
The book is called Social Poverty. Author Sarah Halpern-Meekin is our guest. I'm Keely Boltina. What's your understanding of social poverty? How does your experience change the way that you are an adult now? Tell us your story. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking with Sarah Halpern-Meekin about what she calls social poverty and how a lack of trust and support can contribute to a cycle of struggle. Sarah writes, becoming an adult, getting established in your career, with your finances and your sense of self is difficult. Becoming a partner is difficult. Becoming a parent is difficult. Doing all three at once is enormously challenging. What have you seen a family member endure? What have you gone through? Have you supported friends who felt like they were trying to get their lives together but couldn't because of the people around them? How did you shore up those relationships? 800-642-1234. There's still time to share your story. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor at UW-Madison, and her book about social poverty looks at connections between financial poverty and our roles as romantic partners and as parents. Sarah, why have we not talked about this idea of social poverty before? How have we overlooked it for so long?
I think there is a growing conversation in recent years, a growing focus on the what some call an epidemic of loneliness or social isolation. And there is starting to be some attention from different circles, from different academic fields, from different people in government. The UK in recent years has put in place actually some government ministries that are focusing on the issue of social isolation. And there is growing attention to it in the United States. Unfortunately, in my eyes, that is often focused on social isolation among older adults, among the elderly. And that is certainly really important to attend to. But I think it really relies on our idea about social isolation being something that comes from being alone. And so often the loneliest time that you have in your life is when you're surrounded by people you don't feel connected to. And so that's why we need to look to the research and see that often the loneliest times in people's lives when they feel the most socially isolated are in older adulthood, but also during that transition to adulthood in people's late teens and early 20s. And so we need to really be addressing both those ends of the adulthood life spectrum and supporting people as they're making both of these transitions in life.
And that will help the middle portion there of the life.
Yes.
Chuck in La Crosse is talking about isolation. He can weigh in here. Chuck, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. I take care of quite a few patients. I'm a doctor. I'm an obstetrician. I also do a lot of work with addiction. And one factor you haven't addressed is when you throw the subject of addiction on top of the issues that you just discussed.
Thanks, Chuck. When we're talking about addiction, you know, we've seen that also doesn't follow income. That can be an issue across different areas of wealth or lack of that. How does that factor into it?
So one of the reasons I don't focus on it all that much in this book is because it wasn't an issue for most of the parents who I met. So there was one couple who were struggling with addiction during the year that I met with them. But for most of the people who I met, they were really pulling away from engaging in any kind of substance use as they were becoming parents. And so they were not addicts, so they could successfully sort of stop using any recreational drugs or alcohol that they might have been using before to really focus on successfully fulfilling their parenthood role. But we could certainly imagine that being an addict could be a very isolating experience and could also mean that you don't show up socially for the people around you.
An additional layer to the challenges that these families are already facing trying to find their way.
Absolutely.
We're exploring the concept of social poverty. Author and associate professor Sarah Halpern-Meekin is our guide. I'm Keely Boltina. How do you help people develop strong relationships with one another? What support do you provide in your community? 800-642-1234. Sarah, how do we enact public policies or put some sort of program in place that attempts to address the needs of the socially poor, especially as we struggle to fully define that for everyone?
I think that's a really great question because it reminds us that this is not just about individual social skills, right? Whether you're good at making friends or bad at making friends. But the experience of social poverty can be a result of the structures and institutions and opportunities around you. And we do have control over those. And it can even be the smallest things, right? We can think about how we set up childcare centers. Are there opportunities for parents to socialize with one another and to socialize with staff so they can get to know each other, so there can be a community created there? Or are you just kind of ships passing in the night at pickup and drop off? So a child care center could purposely create opportunities like a cookout for people to get together and start forming relationships. We can also think on a broader scale, right, about some of the programs that I look at here in this book. Do we offer opportunities for people who don't have the financial resources to learn more more about how to have healthy relationships? Do we offer those services to people? So we could offer that in high schools, and some cities and states do that. They offer relationship education in high schools to help people figure out how to, you know, have healthy communication. What are some ideas about good relationships and what's healthy and what's unhealthy? And we can also think about getting creative. How do we design new ideas, new programs to really encourage people to get that financial support, social support, to create those relationships? And so there are some really interesting examples that I find fascinating of programs that allow university students to live in nursing homes for free, as in return for doing some volunteer work and creating relationships with the residents in those nursing homes. And I think that's a great example of how there can be synergy between helping to meet people's financial needs, the needs of university students to have affordable housing, and social needs, not just for those older adults in the nursing homes, but for the younger adults as well, to get some guidance and some wisdom and some friendship from older adults.
How does Wisconsin fit into this this movement that you're seeing in different places across the country? I mean, is there anything statewide or locally that you've seen that Wisconsin is trying to address the challenges you point out?
So there certainly are a variety of programs, for example, that the University of Wisconsin's extension system puts in place. We have, educators in all of our counties here in Wisconsin who put programming in place. And some of that programming is around offering education in parenting or in relationships. And so there is some of that. I think we can be more purposeful in how we build it, not just, you know, at the state level, but into our own practices, into how we set up the businesses or organizations that we're all involved in.
And Kenneth in Janesville says that we don't have housing that facilitates socializing. So is housing another aspect of that that we should be paying attention to?
There certainly are efforts among some people to create what we even would call a co-housing community. So there are some of those here in Madison. There are some all around the country that are focused on having people coming together and living together in a purposeful way, so that you don't just happen to live around each other, but you've committed in advance to creating community where you live and to working together cooperatively and fostering relationships. That would work and wouldn't work for some people, but it's one example of how we can be purposeful and thoughtful in building in social opportunities and building in social structure and community into how we plan our lives.
If all of those things that you've laid out are real opportunities for us, how do we figure out if programs or efforts are successful? I mean, what does that look like for the people who participate in them?
So I think one aspect of programs, especially social service programs that are focused on lower income folks, is that they need to be treated with dignity and respect. Staff should be welcoming them and should be treating them just as they would treat somebody who has all the financial resources in the world. So often people have to leave their dignity at the door when they ask for financial assistance. And so ensuring that we're creating positive working relationships between staff who are helping people get back on their feet financially and those people themselves is really important. So having social programs that include dignity, include respect, include kindness, and foster working relationships so that people get social support through those programs, as opposed to feeling socially isolated by being in those programs.
Sarah, thank you for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she wrote the book Social Poverty, Low-Income Parents, and the Struggle for Family and Community Ties. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to the Ideas Network.